Hello again. This is Tom Polizzi of Finishing.com, the homepage of the finishing industry. Welcome back to The Lost Art of Tin Nickel Plating. This is part two. Along with the bulletin I put together at our website on the information on Mr. Morin's tape, here are some highlights of part two. 1. Stripping salvage of tin nickel coatings. 2. Mr. Morin describes a possible way I think you can make tin nickel powder. The stuff is so compressively stressed that it will crush to a black powder when bent off a mandrel. 3. He mentions that nickel exposed in the bottom of a heat cup is not compatible with stainless steel. Is that an EMF couple problem? 4. Could you barrel plate the inside of a brass tube the size of a ballpoint pen cartridge with any coating that you know of? Listen to this on the tape to understand the throwing power of this plating solution. 5. Polar bonding of organic molecules to the coating. 6. Solderability better than straight nickel. 7. Lost art of plating this alloy contained in this segment, so get out your pencils. Mr. Morin should have been wearing a t-shirt that said, "If I'm talking, you should be taking notes." Here now is part two of The Lost Art of Tin Nickel Plating.
Now, one of the ways that I covered myself at the beginning is that I would always do a thin copper strike to those brass components, because if ever I had a problem with a coating, and it's so rare I don't remember it ever happening, that I could completely strip the tin nickel plating without so much as attacking a copper strike coating in a boiling concentrated phosphoric acid. And yes, that's just about the only way there is to strip. The handbook suggestions on stripping will strip primarily by attacking through the plating to what's underneath. But the only real way of stripping is boiling concentrated phosphoric acid. Now, this is a dangerous procedure. It has to be done only by top-notch guys in a well-protected situation. But what a phenomenal way of salvaging. I wouldn't hesitate at all doing gyroscope parts in tin nickel, fully, as long as they were made out of copper-based alloys, fully realizing that a copper strike would protect me completely. By the way, the plating is also, being an intermetallic compound, compressively stressed. Now, that's both an advantage and a disadvantage. Of course, the advantage is in its corrosion resistance, but the disadvantage is that there's a very limited amount of mechanical co-working that you can do after plating. For instance, a thickness of 5 micron, and let me give you for example here. Let's say it's a piece of brass strip, half inch wide, 10 mils thick, pick a number, and plate it to 5 microns. Now, over a piece of clean white paper, bend it on a compression side, the compression side facing down, and listen to it. You might or might not hear cracking. You may or may not see a little rain of black particles. But to do 10 microns, and you can see that what has happened on the compression side, black powder crushed. And since it's compression, there's an absolute limit to the amount of elongation. So I never plated over 5 micron if I knew that there was such a post-plating operation as might be a dimpling or staking or something in that order. But sharp bend, no. The plating would crack rather than elongate. Another job that came shortly after that was a very contradiction of everything I just said. 3 mils, 003 inches of tin nickel on cast steel valve components for Dow. Now, I say that's a contradiction, but Dow wanted it for its chemical corrosion resistance, well aware of all the things that I've just said about, well, my goodness, at 3 mils thick, you had to be careful how you pack them, because if you dropped it the 6 inches onto a hard surface, the plating would crack as if it was the bottom of a glass milk bottle. It is a very brittle coating. But this was for a super quality caustic that they wanted to make, and they felt that tin nickel would be even better than solid nickel. And it was a successful job. Another one that came shortly after that, also an odd one, also an example of the performance of tin nickel, was General Electric in Allentown, Pennsylvania. Their coffee pots over the years had been brass, solder joints, copper nickel chrome plated, their own very elaborate plating department. And the heat cup in the bottom of the percolator is, imagine if you would, a heavy wall cup. And by heavy wall, I mean, oh my goodness, close to an eighth of an inch thick. That the depth of the cup is about an inch, and that this fixes through the top of the percolator, and the under part of the percolator, the heating elements go against that, and after that a washer and a locking nut to hold the whole thing together. The premise, of course, being that the heating element will boil the water in that little cup, big heat sink, so that the steam can start escaping up the stem to the percolator, and there goes your perking device. Now, when they were copper nickel chroming brass bodies, they would also copper nickel the cup. But they wanted to, and did make stainless steel bodies so that the nickel was no longer compatible. However, again, Tin Research in Columbus recommended that they look at the tin nickel, and it was very successful, but the test. Every morning they would make an 8-cup of Maxwell House coffee, pour out 2 cups, and let it sit all day. Next morning, decant the old coffee out, put in fresh water, make a new pot. This would go on for months, and the tin nickel plated cup would not stain. Why that's important is another reason, and that is that it's completely food compatible. And GE Allentown proved that very well. And that job lasted a surprisingly long time, because it took a long time for GE to solve the problem of going to a stainless steel cup. I don't know what the problems were, but they did sooner or later. But still, it went on to, what was it, a year and a half, 2 years also. So it was quite a job. Another one to illustrate its chemical corrosion resistance was a manufacturer of ballpoint pens, you know, the little brass tube that holds the ink on the inside of the pen, an eighth of an inch in diameter, so 4 or 5 inches long, whatever it is, brass, of course. Could we tin nickel plate the inside of that tube so that it would be corrosion resistant to the very aggressive ink that they wanted to use? And yes, we could barrel plate those without burning the ends. That is to say, it was an even color for its entire exterior. And yet the inside of the tube is so completely plated as to not be attacked by the ink. In fact, I used to pull a trick, a psychological trick, to potential customers with tin nickel. At that time, we had very big bright dip stations, massive fume control system to go with it, of 50-gallon bright dips for big piece and 20-gallon bright dips for small ones. Must have been a wall of about 40 feet long of these bright dips and their rinses. And the fumes, that the nitrous oxide fumes that comes off from a big load of bright dipping, and horrible brown fumes, you know, ventilators with a flap your tie in the wind. So what I used to do is grab a couple of the unplated ballpoint pen ink cartridges and just throw one into a bright dip, and my God, it would fuse and fuss and boil, and brown fumes come off, and then it seemed like in a half a minute it was completely digested and gone. Then I would take a piece of copper wire, wrap it in the middle of the body of the tube, go to the tin nickel plating tank and plate it the wrong way. That is to say, the open ends would be up and down. It would not be facing the electrodes. And I'd walk away and talk to them for a minute or two, then go back, take it out of the tank, rinse it, then move over to the bright dip tank and put it into the bright dip, being careful that the tin nickel plated portion of the wire was also in the bright dip, and not the bare copper. just let it hang in there, and they'd look and they'd stare, and I'd talk for a couple of minutes and finally take it out and rinse it and see, no attack. If that doesn't give you a good idea of throwing power, covering power, and chemical corrosion resistance, I don't know what does. Still another one was the Eklund Company in Branford, Connecticut, wanted to make a ignition point sets that were real hot rods. They had a fancy name for them. Went over big in a trade in those years. And they wanted bright plating. Now, tin nickel is not a very good decorative coating for the reason that it fingerprints. Its ability to hold polar lubricating compounds is also its ability to fingerprint like crazy. However, this was a case of parts that would normally be barrel bright nickel than tin nickel flash, and the reason was they had naturally tried chrome plating them, but the performance of the ignition set was terrible and they didn't understand why. Well, the chrome represented a high contact resistance, electrical contact resistance. So the bright nickel, tin nickel, very pretty coating, like bright stainless steel, bright monel, gave them everything they wanted and was in a protected atmosphere, as far as I was concerned, for corrosion. And it gave them the electrical values. But tin nickel, I would put second only to, well, certainly the equal of most bright golds, that is to say co-alloyed with cobalt and nickel, as to contact resistance. And in fact, except in the case of ball burnish industrial nickel, that is to say specifically processed after plating for contact resistance, tin nickel is superior immediately after plating to ordinary barrel nickel as far as contact resistance is concerned. I would often use it for its compressive stress, sacrificial to copper alloys, as a base for a thin coating of gold. But the reason I didn't succeed in for industry in altogether is, first of all, the operating parameters of the tin nickel are incorrect, and secondly, the understanding of stannic tin was not perceived by those who tried it. But let me go on. Solderability. Now, solderability is not as good as tin, of course, or tin zinc. It is better than straight nickel, but I wouldn't go any further than that. I never did try to sell it on the basis of solderability. There are other materials that do that better. And tin or tin lead, once soldered, that is to say reflowed, are excellent corrosion resistance on copper base alloys, so why bother? Another occasion was a manufacturer of a water control mechanism, some pressure control valve of some sort, had great difficulty in many industrial locations in the United States. I remember Florida and Arizona were two they complained about regularly, where the salts of water would hang up onto the components that were part of his control mechanism. Of course, tin nickel solved that beautifully, and that too lasted for months, till of course we were substituted for plastic. By the way, in all of these cases, being a job shop, you know that sooner or later you're going to lose it. You're going to lose it to substitute materials. For instance, the ballpoint pen went to stainless steel. My God, the material had to be shipped across time zones. Think of all the material in inventory, relying on trucks for production control. It's better to pay a bit more for to have a stainless steel tube rather than all the hassle of the tin nickel plate of brass. I would do the same myself. So the object has always been for the job shop to search new jobs. Now, as far as I was concerned, I would not work competitively, that is to say, the process is special, it's harder to use, requires higher skills, so that you price the job accordingly. So that if every once in a while a particular job came through copper base alloy where I knew he'd have to have the tin nickel, I would quote it. But it didn't pay for me to go out and search these jobs out. Therefore, when I sold my company a dozen years ago, you may say that the source of 10 nickel dried up. There are authors and companies listed in guidebooks, but I've yet to be able to locate one that is doing job shop plating, that is to say, the ability to take work and do it experimentally, rack or barrel. Now, why is it a lost art? Well, as I mentioned at the beginning, the Parkinson draft of the weather solution did not include operating parameters. And these are crucial. A simple thing like the temperature designated at 150 degrees Fahrenheit. Well, you'd say nominal. If you're 148 degrees or 145 degrees or 155 degrees, say, oh, that's normal, I'm within the parameters. Not true. The operating temperature is 150 degree minimum. Yeah, 148, okay, but not 145. None of the formulas include the use of sodium fluoride. Parkinson did in his original formulation, and I always did. It's the grain refiner. It's the grain refiner that not only results in a continual maintenance of the 1-to-1 atomic ratio, but also it's the grain refiner that moves up the current density range. Now, current density. The handbook again says 25 amperes per square foot. Hate to say it, Mac, but that's the maximum. Better not calculate that as your average, because you'll wind up off scale. How do you control such a solution? It turns out to be very easy. You analyze for the nickel and tin content. That's easy. And then a 1-amp, 10-minute Hall cell at 150F. That means you need a temperature-controlled Hall cell on brass panels. And it has to be burnt-free to 40 amperes per square foot and fully bright to 25 amperes per square foot. And you maintain that brightness at 25 amperes per square foot by the addition of sodium fluoride. Never once analyzed for the ammonium bifluoride fluoride content. It's a pH of 2.5 to 2.8. Whatever it takes to get within that pH range. Oh, by the way, that's with the hydronic paper, not with glass electrodes, of course. And at that range, and with your 1-amp, 10-minute Hall cell control, you can deliver diamonds all day long with never a reject. Even the voltages cited are incorrect. Ordinary rack plating, the solution is so conductive. It's from a half a volt to about 2.5 volt, 1.5 volt. And barrel plating, depending on perforation size of the barrel, for instance, a 36-inch barrel with a 100-pound load wouldn't be a 4.5 volt load. Some other things, for instance, there's no mention in the literature, but boy, what a problem it was. And that is, how do you heat the solution? The only material of construction that really works is pure nickel. So that when I first started, I would get steel cow rod units, electric heating elements, and I had beautiful industrial nickels, plate them to about 3 mils thick. And in spite of the expansion and contraction and the presence of a chloride-fluoride solution at 150F, they would still last me many, many months before they pierced through. And the plant was actually steam heat, where that time I had my own plant. It was a 100-man plant. I finally was able to get solid nickel plate coils, and they have an indefinite life. Of course, just be careful to weld them back in the anode so that they don't become bipolar on you. Oh, and the anodes, nickel anodes, roll depolarized. My God, not carbon containing. And the tin anodes, double bag them. Rely mostly on addition of tin chloride for maintenance. Now, maintenance to the solution, that's simple. Never try to activate carbon. If you got oil in there, then you don't deserve to be a plater. You don't get oil in your plating solutions. And the most that could happen was that stannic tin would form from air movement of the solution, aeration, particularly during barrel plating. The maintenance was simple. At 100, when the solution was at operating temperature, pump it out into a storage tank. That'll give you plenty of time to clean out the operating tank, change the anode bags, make sure the Teflon-coated thermostat bulb is in the correct place. And by that time, your operating the solution will have dropped to about 100 degrees Fahrenheit. And filter it back, and it's stainless steel filters. Plastic ones would be better today's language. A 10-micron filter, and that's all the maintenance it ever needed. Of course, except for the daily, Hall cell test. Now, from the pollution control standpoint of today's laws, EPA, OSHA, in those days, we didn't even bother ventilating, so that such a black solution at 150F was not and 100% cathode efficiency, by the way. You can project right to the number. In fact, has made some of the early backscatter standards cuniometrically and directly from the tank, and you wouldn't be able to tell the difference. It's 100% cathode efficiency. So your plating thickness projections are as good as your ammeter and the accuracy of your watch. It's that good.
Hello again. This is Fizz at finishing.com saying so long until next time. If you would like to sponsor a podcast, please visit our website. Copyright 2006, finishing.com.